Shalom, shalom, you fine shalom, the nicest greeting you know. It means bonjour, salut, and skull, and twice as much as hello. It means a million lovely things, like peace be yours, welcome home. And even when you say goodbye, you say goodbye with shalom. It's a very useful word. It can get you through the day. All you really need to know, you can hardly go wrong. You're bilingual as long as you say. Shalom, shalom, the nicest greeting I know. Shalom, 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 means twice as much as hello. It means a million lovely things, like peace be yours, welcome home. Even when you say goodbye, if your voice has I don't want to go in it, say goodbye with a little hello in it, and say goodbye with shalom. Shalom, 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 the nicest greeting I know. Shalom, 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 means twice as much as hello. It means a million lovely things, like peace be yours, welcome home. And even when you say goodbye, if your voice has I don't want to go in it, say goodbye with a little hello in it, and say goodbye with shalom.
Well, I guess you can recognize that was Richard Tucker with Shalom. And okay, I hope that we have a few people listening, even Mickey. Debbie and Joe, are you still up? And Borch, Rachel and Borch, are you listening? Well, look, I have a few people listening. Now, you know, the Chazonis is going to come up in a few minutes, but this is fascinating. I was in the car listening to some of my old tapes from my radio shows when I was on 2 hours of Jewish soul music from Seton Hall University for about 18 years. And I had the 1991, that's 18 years ago, this is the 1991 Yom Ha'atzma'ut 2 hour special. And I happened to listen to my commentary at the time, and Helen and I were just blown away. Blown away. Nothing has changed. Well, it's gotten worse, actually, but I decided that I want to play this for you this evening, and you have to agree with me that it's almost as if it was written yesterday. Okay, this is from one of my radio programs, April 14th, 1991, and you'll hear me make my disclaimer that the words are mine and not necessarily those of the staff and management of WSOU. And fortunately, now that I have this program via the internet, I do not have to make any disclaimers, and I certainly don't make a disclaimer about this. Here we go. 1991, 18 years ago. In the meantime, the following opinions are mine and not necessarily those of the staff and management of WSOU, nor are they necessarily the opinion of the faculty or the administration of Seton Hall University or any of its components. What to make of the proposal by Baker that Syria and Lebanon sit down together with Israel and perhaps even Saudi Arabia? I had a listener call a few weeks ago saying that any Jew who does not believe in miracles is not a realist. And I agree. I mean, there have been so many miraculous things that have happened in our lifetime. The very creation of the State of Israel, and we can go on and on talking about the unexpected things that we've seen. Did we ever expect to see peace between Egypt and Israel? And who can say with any definitiveness as to what will be or what will not be? But we must never forget. We must always remember. And I think that's the important thing. And it's very hard to forget. Douglas Feith, former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense and a Middle East specialist on the National Security Council staff in the Reagan administration, wrote recently in the Jerusalem Post, and I quote, "We need to move beyond the land for peace concept to a clear recognition of the essence of the problem. That is, the passionately held belief rooted deeply in the vivid religious and cultural consciousness of most Arabs that Israel is illegitimate and that no Jewish state, no matter how large or small, should exist in Palestine, which is Arab land." I want to repeat that because I think that this is the essence. This is the issue. He says, we need to move beyond the land for peace concept to a clear recognition of the essence of the problem. That is, the passionately held belief rooted deeply in the vivid religious and cultural consciousness of most Arabs that Israel is illegitimate and that no Jewish state, no matter how large or small, should exist in Palestine, which is Arab land. He goes on, Israelis will not soon forget that when Iraq seized and devastated Kuwait, the Palestinian Arabs en masse exalted Saddam for having done to Kuwait what they wished to do to Israel. They celebrated Saddam's boast to turn Tel Aviv into a crematorium, and literally cheered from the rooftops during Saddam's Scud attacks on Israeli civilians. How can we ever forget this? Feith recommends that our government urge a truly moderate Palestinian leadership, if one should ever develop. And as an aside, I don't know what is a moderate Palestinian leader, and if there ever were such a person, unfortunately, they get their heads blown off. But he says that if such a person should ever come into being, that person or that leadership should take two steps to help convince Israel that they have abandoned the fruitless and costly extremism of their historical cause. First, Feith recommends that they should drop the slogan, Land for Peace, which skeptical Israelis must suspect is a program for dismantling Israel in stages, and they should simply offer peace. They could put forward an open, unqualified, non-grudging, and sincere acknowledgement that the Jewish people are entitled to a state in the Jewish homeland. Well, that's a big first. Let's go on to the second proposal. He says they should abandon the name game by which they apply the label Palestine only to the 20% of British Mandate Palestine that lies west of the Jordan River. So long as one's goal is the elimination of Israel, one does well to pretend that the Kingdom of Jordan, which occupies 80% of Mandate Palestine, is not a Palestinian state. That makes it very easily possible to propagandize that the Jews control all the land and the Arabs of Palestine are stateless. Well, I agree wholeheartedly with Feith. You've heard me quote recently King Hussein, who stated, Jordan is Palestine and Palestine is Jordan, and that's a fact. 80% of the mandate of the British mandate area of Palestine is in Jordan. And Jordan now has over 3 million Palestinian Arabs living within its borders. Let's never forget this. As we celebrate Yom HaAtzmaut, the birth of the State of Israel, We should take a moment to remember some facts of history. I don't know if you've ever seen a map of the proposed partition plan by the United Nations. That's the 1947 partition plan. And in case you've never seen it, let me tell you that over half of Israel, including Judea and Samaria, was given to the Arabs. If you can visualize that their control ran from Beersheba, running parallel to the Mediterranean, almost up to Haifa. They were also given land along the Mediterranean, a few miles south of Tel Aviv, running along the border, halfway down the Negev. They also were to get approximately half of the Galilee. Now, if you saw this map, you would say, why didn't the Arabs accept this? They had half of what is today Israel. But you see, they were not interested in living peacefully together with the Jews. The Jews only had this little sliver of land along the Mediterranean, a sliver of land along the Kinneret, and a good portion of the Negev, which was all desert. They went to war to exterminate the Jews, to push them into the sea, as they said, to rid the land of Jews. Let us never forget that when the Arabs were given half of Israel in 1947, this was unacceptable to them. They wanted it all. They could not accept a Jewish state. They could not accept Jews living on what they claimed to be their soil. Now let's go back to 1967. When the Arabs again waged war against Israel. They held Judea and Samaria, otherwise known as the West Bank. That's the West Bank in which Palestinian Arabs lived, that was part of Jordan, and that was part of the Palestinian state. But this was not enough. Why did they go to war? They already had Judea and Samaria. Obviously, they wanted to exterminate the Jews. This war was waged for the destruction of Israel. Let us never forget, they went to war to exterminate the Jews, as they said, to push them into the sea, to rid the land of Jews. Let's never forget that when the Arabs had Judea and Samaria in 1967, this was unacceptable to them. They wanted it all. And so it was with the Yom Kippur War, the desire to annihilate the Jews, not to live peacefully together with Jews, but to rid the area totally, to make it Judenrein. And is there any doubt that had the evil Saddam Hussein, the butcher of Baghdad, had he had the weapons, that he would have used them to attempt to destroy Israel? Let us never forget that it was Saddam Hussein's intent, his goal, to destroy Israel. And had he waited a few more years until he had had better missiles, and perhaps nuclear capability, is there any doubt that he would have used them against Israel? Let's make no mistake about it. His failure to destroy Israel had nothing to do with his desire to destroy Israel. He had the desire. Thank God he did not have the capability. And how did the Palestinians react to Hussein's intent to destroy Israel? As Fife points out, they celebrated Saddam's boasts to turn Tel Aviv into a crematorium and literally cheered from the rooftops as his Scud missiles attacked Israeli civilians. Let us never forget that it was the hand of God that prevented many hundreds and even thousands of Israelis from being killed by the Scuds. And so, during this moment when we rejoice on the creation of the State of Israel, let us maintain a perspective of history. Let us never forget.